Hello folks, welcome to the show. In this episode, I talked to Russ Murphy, who was a key member of the team that transformed the service culture at Service New South Wales from a fragmented and bureaucratic set of departments into a single, purpose-driven and customer-centric organisation that is now a poster child for customer service. Russ shares how at 12, he saved his primary school bus route, his formative years as a leader exploring his self-awareness in LA, his time in the fashion industry, and then how he came to be a part of Service New South Wales. We hope you can take away some inspiration and ideas as you hear how Russ and the team have made history by becoming the first public service agency in the country to be listed in the top 10 of the Great Place to Work rankings. We hope you enjoy the show.
I had this foundational experience in my mid-20s, which was really unexpected. I actually ended up living and studying overseas in Los Angeles. And it was quite a random opportunity that popped up for me. I hadn't planned on moving overseas to study, but midway through my 20s, I kind of had a quarter-life crisis. And then off the back of that, I got this opportunity to participate in a 2 years master program. And it was the first time that this group called Gateway had run a leadership program like this and accepted international students. And I think actually they stopped running it after about 4 years. So there's maybe three cohorts that went through. Right. And I was the second cohort. So I ended up packing my bags, going over to Los Angeles, being in this group of people where it was kind of 30% classwork, 30% kind of accreditation and qualification. So they taught us how to take people through the Myers-Briggs personality test and the Gallup strengths test. And then we had all these kind of field experiences. So we had interactions with thought leaders, people like Marcus Buckingham and others who were at the time kind of on the cutting edge of, leadership and human performance and organizational science. And then they pushed us out into industry as well. So it was this real mishmash of, experiences, great time, like, kind of highlight of my life. Now that I'm back in Australia with two kids, I kind of pinch myself sometimes to think that I actually got the chance to do that. But they took us through this whole idea of positive psychology and looking at, who you are as a human, what your latent potential is. A lot of times psychology, it's meant to be about the study of human behavior, but it leans heavily towards the study of dysfunction, So we want to try and fix what's not great about people or what people aren't enjoying, whether it's depression or anxiety or, other things that are a bit more serious. And they kind of said, look, that's just half of the conversation or one side of the coin. The other half of psychology and human behavior is what you're great at, what you naturally do well, where you're going. So they spat out this test report for me. They said, you're an activator, which means you have a bias for action. They're like, Russell, you're kind of like ready, fire, aim. You shoot and then figure out that maybe you should have adjusted the target a little bit. Yep. So you got a way of speeding things up. And when you're in a bureaucratic group or a group that's a bit slow to move, you're the one that's putting pressure on them to execute and go forward quickly. And I said, you've got strategic insight. So you usually have a plan. You're usually pretty good at figuring out the plan or the strategy. It doesn't mean that you can write strategy documents, but you have a strategic way of thinking. You have a high level of responsibility. You have strong empathy. You're quite easily able to imagine what it's like for other people to feel things or to think things. And then you care about stuff that matters. So you want to do work that's meaningful and you have this kind of desire to do things that are significant or will make an impact. And then they took us on this journey. They said, we're going to go talent spelunking. And spelunking is where you go abseiling into caves, I think with waterfalls.
Right. Okay.
It's this really gnarly kind of adventure experience. And they're like, we're going to do that with your mind now, which sounds a little bit scary. They didn't put us in a lab chair or anything like that. But they said, we want you to go back pre the age of 16. And then we want you to go back a little bit further before the age of 12. Mm. And the reason for those dates is they explained the kind of brain science behind it. The brain's actually forming all of its connections and pathways in those times. We want you to think about times where you've seen glimpses of these things that we just talked about. Someone said you picked up things really quickly. You're in a state of flow. You did something that no one asked you to do. People commented that you had skill that seemed unnatural for your age. And so these two experiences that I came back to were, as a 12-year-old, I lived in a country town. There was a local bus that used to come and pick us up. And as usual, the kind of local council said, look, we want to save some cash. We're going to change the bus route. We're going to get a bigger company to do it. And the local community decided, well, we don't like that. We're going to have a rally in the local high school. So they got the mum and pop bus driver. You know, they were elderly. They would have been 50s or 60s at this stage. Knew all the kids by name, dropped kids back to farms. Like, it was a real, you know, country, locally embedded service. And the whole town, it felt like, showed up. There would have been a couple hundred people in the hall, and they spoke and they were crying, and there were different people there trying to put pressure on the decision makers, and the local media were there too. And at the end of the night, they just said, hey, does anyone else want to come up and say anything? You know, open floor, anyone want to do some final words? And little 12-year-old Russell, like, no one told me to do this. No one prompted me, but it was like a tractor beam pulling me out the front saying, you got to go talk. So I went up and I just started talking about my experience riding the bus, how, you know, Mrs. Brownlee was her name. She picked us up. She let us listen to music. So in the morning, it was a bit off because the girls picked and it was the Grease soundtrack most days, and we didn't really like that. In the afternoon, it was a bit more rock and roll. We got to put on Aerosmith or Guns N' Roses because it was the boys' turn, and how important that kind of cultural element to the bus ride was. And then I just started kind of cracking into this rant about how it wasn't going to be safe for kids to have to walk down to the main road, and it wasn't fair to leave kids who lived in, you know, far to reach areas, you know, not having a bus service. And I kind of instinctively knew that I had to just leave the room like on a cliffhanger with an emotional punch. And so I said something along the lines of, I don't think this is right and I don't think it's fair. And then I just stopped and froze, and the room erupted. Like, people were cheering and
cheering. Oh, wow.
And then I just kind of walked back to my seat, not really understanding what I'd done, but knowing that I'd kind of succeeded.
Wow.
And so, you know, 15 years later, I'm in Los Angeles unpacking this moment, and they're like, well, there you go. There's the clues to your leadership right there. You took action. You kind of visualized and understood the plan and what was going on and why it mattered. And you had empathy. Like, you could connect your story to the people's emotions in the room, and you move them. And what was really kind of confronting for me, it still is a little bit actually, when I unpack it, you know, it's the thing that I'll talk to about my shrink when my kids are all out of home, is when I went back to school the next day, my little grab at the end was the thing that the local news crew decided to run with the story. So there's this picture of me like working the room, and my experience actually, rather than everyone saying, you know, you saved the bus service, well done, like, actually, I found out later through another really strange set of circumstances that their contract was extended for like another 20 years after that rally.
Oh, wow.
They retired and kind of in the community. I don't know if they had to have more rallies because we left that town a little bit after. But my experience was that all of my friends just made fun of me, you know, and did the Australian thing, like, oh, you're on TV. You think you're a bit good. Are you going to do more speeches? Are you going to be a politician one day? And it wasn't until, you know, in my mid-20s that I actually started unpacking it and going, wow, imagine if someone had to come alongside 12-year-old Russell and said, hey, you got some great skills here. Let's work with you and develop this and stretch this out. Like, there's something here that we can mold and work with.
That exercise of going back and looking at your 12-year-old and 16-year-old self, I think everyone should take a minute to do that, because it would be pretty revealing. And yeah.
But it's if you can handle it, teaches you a lot, I think. You know, and the other thing that I'd say about that, so I ended up, as a result of doing that, going through that program, actually, you know, being able to coach people in that, I've probably taken, I don't know, 5,000 or 6,000 people through a similar experience over a couple of years.
Wow.
And what's really interesting is when you get to that point of the spelunking, you know, going back into the past, for most people, going back into that period of life, it's kind of like the danger zone. You know, there's this like warning signal that flashes, like, this was a tricky time. I remember all the hard things, whether it was the exam that I flunked or the sporting team I got picked last for, or the person who broke my heart. And so our defining experiences, in some ways, I don't know if this is a uniquely Australian thing or not, but they're usually around the negative, which again just reinforces the point that this whole realm of psychology is actually focused on just one half of the conversation. And you got to kind of like blow the dust off, or, you know, shake things a little bit to see actually underneath all of that dirt, there's gold.
Yeah.
And if you can work through it, there's some real beautiful things that will actually unlock a bit of potential in you that other people most likely need to see.
I absolutely agree with you. I think there's so much goodness in that. And geez, we all deserve it as well. We all deserve to explore that and, you know, realize our full potential. So yeah, that's a really, really good message.
The next part of the story, I guess, was I guess a little bit of adversity too. I got to the end of the program and it was kind of July 2008. I don't know if you remember back then, but there was
mm-hmm, I do.
And originally there was a couple of us, so the course that I was involved in, there was an Irish guy, there was a German girl, there was a Mexican guy, a guy from Canada, a guy from New Zealand, me from Australia. About half the cohort of, you know, 12 people were international. So we kind of created this thing called the United Nations, and the Americans didn't really like it because we said to them, you have to apply to join the United Nations study group. We'll tell you if you can be a member. And they were like, why did you come to our country if you're going to treat us like this? Anyway, and that we had a bit of fun, but a bunch of us who were in this kind of United Nations crew, and one of the, you know, one of the key Americans that we loved and was kind of like a, you know, our friendly American. We were all talking about doing something after we graduated, going and running like a leadership center. And there was talk of, you know, being connected into people in New York and going over and working with some people that had some cash and connected with, you know, big money. And the GFC just wiped all of that. And I was probably lucky to get a visa to America. At the time, they didn't have the special visa that Australians have now, where you can just go over for a few years. So my visa ran out, and then I was dating a girl from Arkansas at the time, and she took me home to meet the parents. And it wasn't until after I got back that I realized that that was the moment where I was supposed to propose to her. And
oh, no.
And so our relationship ended pretty quickly after that. It was clear, you know, she was just in a different stage of life than I was. Like, she was ready to, you know, move forward. And that wasn't even something that was on my radar. And not being as self-aware maybe then as I am now, I just missed that. So I ended up, you know, no job, no visa, no girlfriend. back in Australia, August 2008, living in my parents' house, no job. And I just kind of thought, well, we had all these ideas of starting a leadership center, why don't I just do that in Australia? So I started a business, grew pretty small. I was working in a wine store at night just to kind of keep the bills ticking through. And I had a couple of humbling experiences where people that I'd kind of coached during the day in the corporate office came in and bought wine at night. And they're like, oh, you know, business isn't going so well. And, you know, I guess at that point, you got to confront the fact that you're either working or you're not. I think a few people kind of respected the fact that you got to hustle, but there are a few people that I didn't hear from again once they found out I was moonlighting. And eventually that grew. So I ended up working with a few different organizations, had a lot of time working with a group called the Kinchilla Boys Home Aboriginal Corporation, and got to learn about, you know, the Stolen Generation and helping Stolen Generation men who are now kind of approaching retirement age, access things like healthcare and other services, and just had a whole range of different experiences. And then I ended up doing this gig with ING Bank, and it was just before ANZ bought most of their services. This was a couple of years post GFC, and there was, I don't know, maybe 200 leaders in the room. It was like a leadership fundamentals program, and they paid me an extraordinary amount of money for like an hour's worth of work. And I took them through, and some people loved it. And a couple of weeks later, I got a phone call from someone saying, hey, you know, we're going through this big change process. We've got a particular part of our team that needs some resource and some help. Would you consider coming on, you know, not as a contractor, but full-time working with us to, you know, help us manage the change from ING to ANZ. And it was the insurance part of that organization. And I, you know, I'd had some really interesting experiences. Like, I worked with Australia's best steak restaurant in Mildura and kind of coached their team around how to get the best out of things, and worked with a bunch of, like Jewish rabbis in Bondi that all had this kind of, they had this like leadership forum. Most of them were from Israel and living in Bondi, and did some stuff with World Vision, obviously did stuff with the banks and insurance companies. But I kind of felt like having some stability and security would be a good thing. So I took the job with ANZ, worked there for about 18 months, and kind of realized, you know, the banking industry wasn't for me. And one of my mentors at the time actually said, you know, Russell, entrepreneurs and financial institutions, they either end two ways. You know, it's either jail time or you become the CEO. So you're probably not going to be the CEO. It's probably not the best culture fit for someone who likes change and disruption as much as you do. And I don't know if that was a comment on my like morals or, you know, just general skill set, but he had a way of getting to the brutal truth, you know. So I went out on a job hunt, and I ended up actually probably doing a 6-month application to work with someone in a privately owned fashion company. And it took 6 months because she wasn't quite sure. You know, I had no background in retail fashion, didn't know anything about dress ups and colors. But I guess she could see that I had the ability to do the cultural stuff and the training and leadership stuff. And she was really trying to build a culture of leadership in their core brands. So they had Sportscraft, Saba, Jag, a couple of other brands. So she ended up saying, okay, let's do it. You know, I'll bring you on board. And in some ways, it was the most amazing job I've ever had, you know, playing dress ups at work. But the culture was tough. You know, the industry at the time was around the time that Topshop and Zara and H&M, they all opened in the year that I worked in this fashion company in Australia. And they just completely disrupted the industry. And so there's incredible pressure on every team to sell every week. And there were redundancies a couple of weeks after I walked in the door. And my boss as well, you know, we had a pretty tough relationship. She was a brilliant creative, really exceptional kind of solo leader, but really, really kind of struggled to lead a team. And in the end, we clashed a fair bit. And in hindsight, I kind of realized that other people in the company had been putting a lot of pressure on her and even telling her that she wasn't going to succeed and that our whole division was a waste of money.
Oh, wow.
She never told us that, to her credit. But we kind of felt the pressure, and I guess it became personal because we never talked about the actual problem. A lot of the relationships became challenging. And one of the team ended up leaving, you know, on not great terms and landed the job of head of HR for this new startup in government called Service New South Wales. And she called me maybe every week for a couple of weeks saying, you know, do you know anyone? Send me any resumes. I need some people to do leadership. And then she kind of again just cut to the chase and said, look, I know you don't enjoy working there. I've seen the way your boss works and the way the two of you don't get on. Why don't you come and do this? You know, I'll offer you a 1 year contract. Just come and see what it's like. It can't be any worse. I'll give you a little bit more money. And I ended up accepting the role and then had a bit of a fight around my release date, and you know, it got a bit ugly actually, partly because she was kind of poaching people, they felt. But started in this government startup, and you know, I tell people I had a really dim view of government when I first started. I didn't really, I was highly skeptical of government's ability to reform itself. And, you know, I guess the words of my mentor ringing in my ear about bureaucracy and entrepreneurs. And I stepped into an organization that was really, it had hugely ambitious goals and it was looking like some of them might not be accomplished. The people in the team just scrambled. Like, they figured it out. They created post-it notes. They had shapes and colors. So, you know, roads tickets went over to this color and other tickets went over to this color and business tickets went over here. And they hustled and they made it happen. And that's been my experience of Service New South Wales the whole time that I've been there. The different teams that I've worked with, the different executives that have led the organization, there's always been a sense of hustle and a sense of let's get it done for the customer. And you can't really bottle that. And in some ways it's a bit of a mystery as to how we've done that. I think the organization probably just has a great value proposition that people buy into to make government services better, you know.
Yeah.
Everyone wants to do it. So from then on, it was, I guess the first 18 months were really about making sure as each site opened, and there was 20 in the first year, that we opened them successfully, that we went back and wrapped around the teams that maybe didn't have a great opening and didn't benefit from the learnings of Site 20. And then there was a bit of a revolution. And I actually thought about leaving. I wasn't quite sure that I wanted to stay. My role kind of got changed and I was kind of in charge of everything, onboarding, and then I was just in charge of a part of it. And then eventually I was just working to someone else who was in charge. And we never really had a conversation like, Russ, you're not going to be the boss anymore. You're not doing a good job. There was just a series of people making decisions that ended up kind of sidelining me. And someone said to me, you know, there's this experience that you have in an organization, particularly one that trades on value and empathy and loyalty and getting it right for the customer, where it's a little bit like a J curve. If you think about the way the J is shaped, the top of the J is like your high expectations, the brilliant story that you get sold, you know, the employee value proposition, the day one story of how excellent we are and how much you're going to love it. And then at some point your expectations get shattered. You know, you have an experience like I have where there's a restructure and the cards just don't fall your way, or you get tough feedback, or something goes wrong and, you know, you've got to pick up the pieces. And so you kind of drop to the bottom of the J curve. And then really the choice about where you move after that is up to you. Because the reality is it's never as good as what you might have been sold on day one or seen on a website. And it's never as bad as your experience, you know? So just like you wouldn't want you to be judged by your worst day or your worst moment, you shouldn't judge the organization by when stuff goes wrong and their worst moments. That you're the only one who can kind of go back up and calibrate yourself in the middle of that chain. Go, okay, I've got the good, I've got the bad, and I figure out how to, you know, integrate and synthesize what's happening here and make it work for me. Yeah. And then I guess I ended up being able to do that. I moved into the call center team, worked a lot with them. I've been working on a leadership program in the role that I kind of moved out of, and took elements of that program and worked exclusively with the call center team for a while on that. And then the original call center manager decided that she wanted a career change and moved into a different role in the organization. So they kind of asked me, you know, do you want to go and fill in for a couple of weeks? She's going to have some travel and then probably not going to come back. And we just need a little, we need someone to kind of, you know, hold the fort and keep it together while we figure out who's going to step in next. So I was like, yeah, okay, you know, no worries. It was a good opportunity. It was a pay rise. I'd done a little bit of call center work in the fashion company and at ANZ, but never led a call center, you know, and I actually really enjoyed it and had a great relationship with the person who brought me in. And then she got a promotion, so someone else who was a peer in the team became the boss. And it was during that time that the New South Wales government implemented a whole heap of changes. So they built this motorway called WestConnex. They decided to amalgamate a lot of council areas and get them to join together and rationalise the number of local governments in New South Wales. They had a light rail construction that was happening. They decided at one point to close the greyhound industry. There was all kinds of things that were going on. And basically our call centre team, there was about 100 of us, became the phone-a-friend for all of those issues. So we had what we called a rapid deployment team, which sat under another leader, and literally someone in government would pick up the phone and say, hey, this is what we're doing. When can service start taking calls?
Wow.
And what we ended up doing was creating this, we called them, I think, Team Platinum, but they were basically like an A team that people had to apply to join this team and be part of it, who would kind of handle the difficult issues and might get thrown random stuff. And I think at one point we're doing a graffiti hotline, and another point we're doing like recycling of cans. And service was also building its product suite. So we launched the My Service New South Wales product during this time. We launched the digital license program. So there's a whole heap of disruptive change, a whole heap of innovative change that was happening, and a lot of government priorities that were all happening at the same time as well. And what that did actually, it created this sense of buy-in. So people, rather than being a victim and saying, oh man, I've got another Greyhound call today, like, I can't believe they're making me do this, the team actually had signed up for it. They've said, look, I want to be part of this. I'm putting my hand up. And if they didn't really want to be a part of it anymore, it was getting too tough, they could go back and do the other calls that they'd done before. There was nothing holding them to being in the team. But it created this really tight-knit dynamic, you know, that they loved picking up the new work, dealing with it. And I think in some ways they become a bit of an inspo to the rest of the calls.
Yeah.
To be able to move that way. And the team already had a reputation for moving quickly and dealing with crises, but it went on warp speed. And I think at the end of 2016, we counted up and we launched a new initiative every 4 days or something like that. So the pace of change was just immense and rapid. So that was me, leading the call center, being right in the thick of it, kind of figuring it out as I went. I think what maybe enabled me to learn about how to run a contact center and the nuts and bolts of what you needed to do was I was kind of designing this leadership process on the side. So I had to learn what good looked like to be able to create an experience for other people to learn how to do that. And then because I'd taken a lot of people through the leadership journey, it meant that when we needed leaders, I could kind of already identify who might be a good fit for the different things that were happening. And then off the back of that, we had, you know, a lot more rapid growth. We started working with another big organization, iCare. We brought in some other groups, I think from Transport for New South Wales. And so there was some big ticket items that happened in terms of the scale of the contact center. And when I started, it was maybe 300 people. And by the time I left, it was kind of 600, something like that.
Wow.
So it doubled in size, a lot of change, a lot of growth. And really, in some ways, you know, we were kind of white knuckling it. But in other ways, I guess we just had this value proposition at the center, which meant that, you know, we were here to serve the people of New South Wales. And I used to joke, like, we're putting service back in the public service. You know, we're literally here to look after people and serve people. And it doesn't matter what they call about. Yeah. We're gonna try and take care of them. And by and large, people bought into that.
Yeah, that's pretty powerful because you, particularly in contact centers, people can come to work and see their job as being just a small piece of a bigger cog, or I'm just here to answer calls or process these tasks in this queue. But if they come in and this is not just contact centers, this is work in general, but if people come to work and they're like, we're just here to serve the people that come to us. I mean, that is, that's what you want. That's what everyone wants, I guess. And it doesn't really matter the nature of the work or whether it fits beautifully into their job description or the queue that they've come into work. If they're there just to serve people, that's beautiful. The other thing I'm curious about is, so before Service New South Wales became Service New South Wales, it was all of these disparate servicing functions within the different departments, right? Yeah. Was my understanding. And then someone said, well, let's bring these all together. And like you said, you know, you were white knuckling it and people call in and it could be a greyhound call or recycling or something. Like, why did they choose to disrupt themselves like that and create this central unit? Like, because it seems like it's incredibly challenging. Perhaps there's external forces that I haven't thought about yet, but why would a government department choose to go in this sort of huge transformation around customer service? There's no competition. People can't go anywhere else for this stuff. So what drove it?
Look, I think there's probably a couple of answers to that. Just at a high level, you know, in a political sense, people generally rate governments on how basic things happen. You know, does my rubbish get picked up on time? Are there potholes in the road? Is it easy to renew my driver's license? So on that front, New South Wales in 2011, and this is publicly available, and we used to quote it a lot back in the early days, we were rated the worst in customer experience. You know, we literally were a burning platform. Mm. There was about 3,000 phone numbers, a couple hundred different websites, a couple hundred shop fronts around the state. You had to go from place to place. Mm. The process, you know, and talking about the process, you know, not the people, the process to renew your license in person actually took 10 minutes for it to be printed on the spot. So literally that meant if you walked up and your person six, it's going to be 60 minutes minimum, because it takes 10 minutes for all the people in front of you to get served. So just addressing bottlenecks like that in the process, improve things. And I guess the other insight is we had really great leaders. So but before that, looking after people who need to deal with government, it just makes sense. And it's amazing that in the 70s and 80s, when we're much more process driven, you know, I used to talk about the fact that previously policy was like this prison and government departments use policy to stop themselves from helping people. It's like the policy is stopping me from doing that, or I can't help you, or you must, or you've got to. We just said, well, what if policy, instead of becoming the prison, it becomes the foundation? So if you step off the foundation, you're kind of in the red zone and there might be a sinkhole. But if you stay on the foundation, actually, there's a whole heap of things you can do. And policy can actually be an enabler rather than a restrictor of making things better. So I think you had some people who took risks, and, you know, the organization's gone through all kinds of evolutions and phases. Certainly where it started when I was there in 2013 is very different to what it is today. We've had great leaders. Even the last 2 years, you know, I think where service is now and what we represent to the people post-bushfire, flood and pandemic is wildly different to what anyone could have imagined we would have been in 2013. You know? People using our app every day to check in, people getting their information from our call center about where can I go, what can I do. In some ways, it's, you know, it's just fortuitous that this group of people were the ones that got to implement it, because it just makes sense.
Yeah.
Look after your citizens, look after your customers. Make it easy, make it simple, strip out the complexity, and hire people and allow them to care. It's a no-brainer.
I love that, yeah, allow them to care. And I imagine that has a massive impact on more broadly. Like if you're influencing, you're touching so many people every day through Service New South Wales, and if they're getting a great experience, they're leaving happy, that flows on to society at large. It's got to be a positive, more broadly.
Yeah, hopefully it's an inspiration, not a not a threat. And yeah. Big government, I think it's a bit easier, I think, to be an inspo than to be a disruptor or a challenger.
Yeah. It sounds like, from what you said so far, that, you know, people really relished this change and rolled up their sleeves and got into it. But imagine there must have been some resistance in different areas. What did that look like, and how did you take people on this journey of change?
Yeah, I think everyone goes through, you know, there's the, what do they call it? The diffusion of innovation. So you have like the innovators and the, you know, the middle group, and then you've got the laggards or the nostalgics. And so if you think about that innovation bell curve, which I think if you just Google diffusion of innovation, you probably find Simon Sinek talking about it. He tends to get credit.
He does.
I don't think he came up with it, but, you know, there's another guy who's who you should check out, and who was in the right place at the right time. But we, I think in government, typically you're led by late adopters and nostalgics, typically. So people who are suspicious of change, want to, you know, preserve and protect and legislate and, you know, be guardians of, you know, the crown jewels back in the day. And so what's happened with service is that you've kind of changed the leadership of the front face of the organization with people who are much more comfortable being at the front end of the curve. They're maybe not the super innovators who are living in the future, you know, thinking about colonizing Mars or whatever it is that's there. But they're the early adopters. You know, they're the mushroom eaters. We used to talk a little bit back in the day about being crash test dummies, you know, like we're putting on our helmets and we're proving that government can survive this kind of disruption and change. Some of the other cultural touch points, you know, from a frontline perspective, everyone wore wardrobe, and it was designed by the same people, I think, that designed the Virgin Australia wardrobe. So it looked a lot better. We got some complaints about how it felt. You know, some people didn't like the scratchy fabric. Having worked in fashion previously, you know, I got a lot of those complaints once people figured that out. Hey, Russ, how do I tailor this? You know, but the wardrobe actually made a difference too, because all of a sudden you're walking into this environment where everyone's dressed semi-professionally and looking sharp, and you've had to make zero effort to do that. We've given you a couple hundred dollars worth of wardrobe. We've encouraged you to make sure, like I think in the original 20 sites, we had tailors that went out as people did their onboarding training, made sure that people fit and did custom cuts and, you know, because that kind of stuff matters, right? And that there's a message to people when you're doing that, that actually we want you to feel comfortable. We want
That's unreal.
Obvious. We want you to look good. I think the physical design of the sites actually helped as well. You know, there's this theory that if you want to kick a habit, like you're a smoker or you want to, you know, give up dairy, sometimes the best thing to do is to change your environment. Don't go back to the same place you went on holidays and same rhythms that you used to do, like try and disrupt things. And that's why I think rehab works too, right? Because you're going to another environment. There's none of the threats and opportunities. And so disrupting our physical environments, making them much more minimalistic, taking away the screens, you know, standard branding, making them look clean and nice and comfortable. The blue, the gray, the flat counters, the wood, all of that was designed to create a look and feel that was, you know, authentic, natural, encourage people to connect. And, you know, that all of those touch points, I think, help to create that dynamic for people that you're stepping into something new. And so it's almost like a ritual, you know, of like we're letting go of the old, stepping into the new. It's probably going to be some things that you'll bring with you. And the reality is you can't take people on that journey. People have to choose to come. And some people in every organization always leave a little bit of them in the old ways and the old team and the old environment. But the pace of change at service has been so fast that they haven't been able to leave that part of them back there for too long.
Yeah.
You know, we're moving at speed and we're working for the people. So, you know, even if it's hard and you've got to give something up and it's not how it used to be, you know, we're doing this to make things better for all of our citizens and customers. So there's a bigger picture. And the other thing that we did, we tried to do consciously in all of the changes that I was involved in. There's probably, you know, a couple of thousand people that have migrated. I think the last time I checked, we were about 70% ex-government employees, which is really unique and something that in the early days we used to talk about a lot, because people said you'll never be able to do this with the existing employees. They just won't change. Mm, you know, yeah. they're too rusted on. But actually, that 70% mark of ex-government employees was proof that actually they can change. Mm. If you treat people with respect, you give them the training and the tools, you let them buy into the values, and you change the environment, actually people will get on board with what's happening. So that was a nice way of also kind of celebrating what had happened before. There was always a conscious factor of let's celebrate what these people have done, you know?
Yeah.
It can be easy to feel like it's a corporate takeover and the new brand's here, we're not talking about the old brand anymore and everything old was bad. And, you know, if you do that, you just, you unnecessarily upset people.
Yeah.
And you're playing the man, not the ball, right?
Yeah.
You're making
it
about the people rather than the structure and the process and the policy that was in place.
I've definitely learned the hard way a number of changes that I've been involved with over the years, that not acknowledging the past and acknowledging what people have brought and contributed, because people have a natural fear of change, and some of that is driven by their own personal, their self-worth or their connection to the work. And if you automatically say to people, well, we're going to change everything, people start thinking, well, was what I've done before not valuable enough? Am I now not as worthwhile as what I was before? I think that's so important in making sure that you, and there's a lot that you can, that people still have from like the old world that still is important in the new world. Mm. It's really important to think through that stuff very intentionally.
Yeah. One of the things that we actually did, well, that service did really well early on, I say we, but it wasn't much to do with me at all. The values that the organization came up with were actually quite visceral. And they were really deeply embedded through the organization. Like oftentimes values are just like a thing that you put on the wall and it's like we promise to, you know, look after all of our customers and never let anyone down. And, you know, you don't have to go far to see that there's a huge dissonance between the value statement on the wall and what's actually happening on the front line.
Yeah.
But at service, they workshop stuff, you know, before my time. They came up originally with these three really simple but hard to do values, right? Passion, accountability and teamwork. So three things that it's easy to see when they're happening, but quite hard to move someone from not doing them to actually doing them. But also really interestingly, and someone pointed this out to me, there are three things that most people agree with you need to have. So if you talk about accountability, most people say, yep, someone should be accountable, just shouldn't be me. If you talk about teamwork, most people will be like, yeah, teamwork's great. I just want to do my own thing, but teamwork in general is great.
Yeah.
You know? Like other people should do what I want to do when they're in the team. And then lastly, yeah, it matters. Like people should care. They should be passionate. Mm. And there was probably some debate about whether or not to use the word care or passion, but I think passion was a bit more movement oriented. So care is about, you know, come and we'll look after you. Passion's actually very active. And it's about saying there's going to be a sense of movement and energy about this. And we talked a little bit about how in the teams that I was a part of, you know, passion, accountability, teamwork, really they relate back to self-awareness, proactivity, and relational intelligence. So, you know, being accountable really is about being proactive, taking responsibility, being the one who takes initiative, says, yes, I'm going to own this. Yes, I'll call you back tomorrow, even if I don't have an answer. No, you're not going to have to call five times and speak to five different people. Like, we'll write something down. We'll make sure everyone knows, you know, we're going to go the extra mile and really, really step into this. I think self-awareness really is about passion, you know, knowing what your levers are, what your drivers are, what you care about, what upsets you. And self-awareness is something that no one can do for you, you know?
Mm.
And often I think in my life, my experience has been realizing how unself-aware I actually am, how much further I have to go. It's kind of like a well, you know, you dig and you hit some nice water, but then you're like, oh, actually we can go deeper. Like there's way more to explore in this area. And then relational intelligence is teamwork, right? Getting on with people, not just knowing yourself, but being able to read the room, being able to learn how to get people to work together, dealing with conflict, driving value through common goals. So those things, I think, kind of stuck the organization together and gave people like a way of getting on board. Like, you know, do you intellectually assent to these three things being important? Passion, teamwork, accountability. Okay, cool. So let's go and do it. And let's all do it together. Let's not just let other people do it. And let's do it for the people and be the servants.
I love that. That's revealed a little bit more about, I suppose, how you're able to do so much change and achieve some of the things that you guys have is because they're very humanistic, those three, and there's a real, they're very intrinsic. Like if you can get people to tap into those, it kind of lights the fire within. And
yeah,
I think a lot of like the extrinsic, this comes back to Dan Pink when I listen to you, is the power of the intrinsic motivation is that's where it's at. You know, the external stuff might be there, might be okay for a point in time, but we, too often we try to have those things on all the time and they're just not effective in really, when you are going through such a change, like the one you guys did, you need people to get up out of bed in the morning and go, I want this. I want all the challenges as well as the good stuff.
Yeah.
That's great. Hey, mate, we might wrap it up there, but I could keep talking to you all day about this stuff. It's amazing. And your journey, I didn't know, I've obviously spoken to you a little bit over the years, more about the work stuff, but your personal journey to get where you are has been really incredible to hear, and it's got me thinking about a lot of stuff. So I really appreciate you sharing that with us today.
Yeah, no worries. It's interesting. You know, I was thinking about what to talk about. I guess the experiences that you have really shape you as a leader. You know,
yeah.
So in some ways, it's a bit strange to talk about what you've done without talking about how you got there.
Very good. Thank you so much, Russ. I will let you go.
Thanks so much for having me on. Really enjoyed it. And, you know, great to see you yesterday. Hopefully we get another in-person catch up at some point in the future. Sean, always enjoyed our chats. And
yeah, mate.
All the
me
best
too.
To you and the team.
Yeah. Me too, mate. Thank you so much. Talk to you soon. Thanks.